This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents On a Night of a Thousand Stars, written by Andrea Yarura Clark, read by Paula Christensen. For My Mother. Chapter 1. July, 1998. I stood a short distance from the polo field, observing my father, Santiago Larrea, gallop furiously alongside one of his rivals. Plenty of room remained in the stands at the Southampton Polo Club, but, like the players' spouses and friends, I preferred the view from ground level, where I could feel the thundering of hooves, the thwack of mallet on ball, and the churn of mud and grass. Beyond the field, a vista of dense woods seemed to thin out with each passing year, as moneyed New Yorkers continued to fill all available acreage and airspace on the South Fork of Long Island with enormous summer homes. I had arrived late, and now I glanced at the scoreboard. The teams were tied. As always, Dad's team included a couple of ringers he had flown up from his home country of Argentina. Being invited to play for a season on Santiago Larrea's team in the Hamptons was an opportunity that few Argentinian players on the polo circuit could resist. Dad was admired by his fellow countrymen, not only for being a top amateur polo player, but also for his decades of success as an investor on Wall Street, where he was known for his ability not merely to dodge, but also to anticipate the region's recurring crises. The opponent tried to hook Dad's mallet, but the maneuver caused his pony to stumble, and my father pulled ahead. A teammate swiftly smacked the ball his way. My father kicked the underside of his favorite pony, Charlie, and bent to the right to begin his backswing, his torso nearly parallel to the ground. The mallet struck the ball straight through the goalposts. Seconds later, the bell rang, indicating the end of the last chucker and the match. Dad sat back up, patting Charlie's neck as his teammates trotted in a circle around their captain, clicking their mallets high in the air. The players on Dad's team rode to the tent at the end of the field that had been set up with folding chairs and a large white cooler of drinks. Dad dismounted and turned to my mother, who had just left her coterie of girlfriends to join him. The assembled ladies had donned their best tournament attire for the occasion, including an array of bright-colored ruffled dresses and an array of hats, from Jacquemus to Bolero. Mom had opted for a long celestial blue summer dress and espadrilles.
Lila, did you see that final shot?
My dad asked my mom.
Unbelievably close, but we pulled it off, didn't we, Charlie?
He stroked the pony's snout. As usual, he had saved his best pony for the crucial moments of the last chucker. The steed was dripping with sweat, and Dad handed the reins to one of the grooms.
You played very well, my dear.
You always do,
Mom said, handing him a glass of iced tea. He took a long drink. I picked up my weekend bag and entered the tent. They turned to greet me, but my mother's smile inverted slightly when she saw I was not dressed for the occasion. It was usually acceptable to attend a polo match wearing jeans and a t-shirt, but not at the big charity tournaments, as on this particular weekend. Full skirts or dresses below the knee were the norm for women, while men sported khakis, button-down shirts, and blazers. I chose to ignore her frown and kissed her.
Where have you been, darling?
Dad asked, wiping his sweaty brow with a riding glove before kissing me, too.
We thought you were coming out yesterday.
My father was unfazed seeing me in a pair of ripped jeans. He wouldn't have cared if I had shown up in sweatpants. He was always happy to see his only child. I grinned up at him.
I missed my connecting train, but I caught the last chucker. You were great.
It was the summer between my junior and senior years of college, and I had been living with my friend Emily in a sublet in Park Slope, Brooklyn. Express trains to the Hamptons from Atlantic Terminal were infrequent, even at the height of the summer season. Juan Godoy, one of Dad's players, approached us with a relaxed, bow-legged gait,
the result of riding horses since before he learned how to walk.
Paloma, you are here, finally,
Juan said with a pronounced accent, unbuckling the chin strap on his riding helmet. His dirty blonde hair lay flattened to his forehead.
Hello, Juan, I said with a smile. You know I only come to one of these things per season, and only for my dad.
When I first met Juan a few weeks ago at my family's home in Manhattan, he had ignored the unspoken dress code for the dinner party, showing up in a pair of slim-fitting jeans and white t-shirt under a beige linen blazer. He spent most of the evening chatting up an Argentinian actress who was in town promoting a film she'd made with the guest of honor, a well-known Spanish director. So I was surprised when, at the end of the party, Juan sought me out to ask if I would show him around Central Park. His sun-bleached hair flopped down over his honey-brown eyes, firmly centered on mine, seeming to know the answer before I uttered it.
Well played, Juan,
my father said, still beaming from their exploits on the field.
This has been an amazing season, he said. I can't thank you enough for the opportunity to play on your team.
You'll be at the party tonight, yes?
My mother asked Juan.
It would be my pleasure to spend an evening in the company of the La Rea ladies.
Juan touched my shoulder lightly.
Come with me to check on the ponies.
Polo players generally bring at least 8 ponies to a match. The 6 chuckers last only 7 minutes each, but that is long enough to exhaust a pony that continuously gallops across the length of a 300-yard field. The visiting ponies were taken to the trailers, but Dad and his team had use of the stables on the club's grounds. I picked up my bag, but Juan swiftly insisted on carrying it for me. The chivalrous gesture marked one more way in which he differed from most men I had dated up until then. I didn't see myself with him forever, and though he was in his late 20s, 7 years older than I was, I doubt he did either. Yet our fling offered a reprieve from the doldrums of a summer in New York City.
I've missed you, he said, grabbing my hand. I was lonely at the dinner last night, and you didn't come to watch our match earlier this week. You're my good luck charm, you know.
But you won them without me anyway. So, it seems you have plenty of good luck charms.
His scent was a pungent mixture of sweat and oiled leather from the horse saddle, sheer masculinity emanating from every pore. The thought made me want to laugh out loud. Instead, I bit my cheek, and hand in hand, we headed to the stables. Later that afternoon, more than 100 guests descended on my parents' summer home, gathering for cocktails on the manicured lawn that sloped gently from the sprawling cedar shingle structure toward the sea. Every summer, my parents hosted their friends and business acquaintances to a traditional asado, an Argentine barbecue, on a night after one of the major polo tournaments. I was still in my bedroom, where I slid into a sleeveless black linen dress as the guests arrived. My dark hair, wet from the shower, was pulled back in a messy chignon, my bangs to the side. I picked up a pair of dangling sea glass earrings and eyed them critically. The wiring was imperfect, but they were one of my first designs, and I cherished them. I had discovered jewelry making only a couple of years earlier, during the fall of my sophomore year at a small liberal arts college in New England. I was majoring in literature and had little experience in design or craft making, but decided to sign up for an art elective in an attempt to stave off the ennui of another long winter. I soon found that the creative process tamed the dull ache of apprehension I had carried inside from a small age. When a few friends began wearing my designs, my roommate Emily suggested that if I worked on the creations, she would find the customers. Emily, who was born to work in marketing, was my first true best friend. And I agreed. Not having thought much yet about what I would do after graduating from college, I fantasized about the two of us opening a boutique in New York. I put on the earrings and steeled myself for the party. It didn't matter how often I attended one of my parents' events, I was never completely comfortable, and I realized now that I was also no longer really interested. What had once seemed a glamorous and mysterious milieu now felt like an obligation. After one final self-appraisal in the mirror, I made my way down the stairs. When my parents had bought the beach house some 15 years ago, my mother had lightened the rooms by installing larger windows and discarding the antique rugs. The expansive living room with its imposing fireplace now had sliding doors that opened onto a covered veranda. The most recent home improvement had entailed swapping out what Mom deemed the dull, dark brown dining room set for a natural blonde wood table with cushioned wicker chairs for a more informal beach feel. After greeting a few guests in the entrance hall, I whisked myself outside, past the blooming rhododendrons, toward the towering white tent erected on the far side of the lawn. Garlands of bistro lights crisscrossed the ceiling, and high round-top tables covered by white tablecloths were decorated with votive candles and small centerpieces of fresh flowers that my mother had ordered from a farm stand a month in advance. Women came in short or long dresses and delicate flat sandals. Their dates wore linen or khaki pants and colorful sports coats over button-down shirts, along with sockless loafers. Guests sipped champagne and feasted on empanadas passed around on silver trays by the catering staff. These turnovers filled with meat or cheese were the teasers before the main event, a series of different cuts of beef grilled to perfection by a grill master Dad flew in from Argentina every year for the occasion. Dad enjoyed little more than the opportunity to show off his quincho, a purpose-built red brick structure adjacent to the house that contained an enormous wood-fired parrilla. The ritual of grilling the meats provided guests with another form of entertainment in addition to the jazz and tango band. The smell of smoldering cuts and rising smoke drew a mesmerized crowd around the quincho. Watching the maestro, as Dad called him, expertly adjust the cooking temperature of the different cuts by raising or lowering the chain-suspended grates above the natural wood coals was its own spectacle. My parents were conversing with a small group near the stage. Dad was in an impeccable navy blue linen jacket and a crisp white shirt. Mom, who never missed a yoga class and religiously protected her skin from the sun by donning wide-brimmed hats and oversized sunglasses, looked much younger than her 42 years. Tonight, she wore a peach-colored silk summer dress over her willowy frame. Her hair was parted down the middle, falling to her bare shoulders. Both my parents were from Argentina. While my father, like me, had dark features common among his Spanish ancestors, my mother, a granddaughter of British settlers of the Argentine Pampas, had green eyes and blonde hair. Her creamy pale skin and faint lingering British mannerisms sometimes confused people. She would briefly explain her family's background and their migration to Argentina after the turn of the century to look after the family's agricultural interests. "The European settlement is similar to what happened in the United States," Dad might add, as enchanted listeners nodded in understanding. I reached my parents just as a family friend took the microphone from the band leader and clinked his glass to call for silence.
"Good evening, everyone. My name is Michael Harris. I'm an old friend and business partner of our host, Santiago. Ever since he first moved to New York from Buenos Aires, I've witnessed his many successes, both off and on the polo fields."
He turned to my father.
"I'm happy to say that tonight, there's something more to celebrate than just this incredible man, his beautiful family, and his prowess with a mallet, not to mention on the dance floor."
The crowd laughed again.
"The official announcement will be in 2 weeks, with all the appropriate pomp and circumstance, I'm sure. But as a few of you already know, Santiago has been appointed Argentina's ambassador to the United Nations."
A few oohs and ahs faded into loud applause, punctuated by a quick bada-boom on the snare drum.
"Congratulations, old friend, and salud!"
Following the announcement, well-wishers and family friends surrounded our family of three. I fielded the usual questions about my studies and summer plans until Juan rescued me.
"There you are. I've been looking for you. You look gorgeous. Someone wants to meet you."
He led me toward a caramel-haired, middle-aged woman, raising her hand at us.
"Hi, I'm Paloma," I said. "Nice to meet you."
Graciela. The smiling woman began to introduce herself, but stopped short as I approached. She looked at me quizzically through tortoiseshell glasses.
Graciela de Graaf. But everyone calls me Grace, she resumed. Such a pleasure. When Juan told me he was dating Santiago Larrea's daughter, I just had to see you with my own eyes. I knew your father in Buenos Aires, but we lost touch years ago when I moved to Holland.
Have you seen him yet?
Not yet, just from afar. He's been very busy tending to his many guests,
Grace said with a laugh.
Like the Santiago I remember, always surrounded by a million friends.
She took a caipirinha from a passing waiter.
These are lethal, but delicious.
Let me bring you to him, I offered. I'm sure he'll be happy to see you.
Taking Grace by the arm, I called out to my parents across the lawn. Dad squinted as we approached, but then returned to his conversation with an elderly couple.
Your parents are just as good-looking as they were 25 years ago,
Grace remarked.
You knew my mother, too?
Oh, yes. Everyone knew Santiago and Lila,
Grace said.
I was happy to learn they had a child.
Really? You sound as if you were surprised.
I don't know. I guess we didn't talk about having kids back then,
she said wistfully.
We were kids ourselves.
Papa, Mama, look who I just met.
My parents greeted Grace with blank expressions.
Santiago, it's been a long time.
Grace went to kiss him hello, but something in his eyes made her stop.
Grace Diaz,
Dad pronounced slowly.
It's de Graaf now. I've been married, divorced, and recently remarried. How's that for a good Catholic girl? Terrible, I know,
she laughed.
But I keep reminding myself that I made a much better decision the second time around. Anyway, you must meet Eric. He's here somewhere.
She gestured vaguely out toward the party.
We'd love to meet him, Dad said.
He turned to my mother.
Can you believe it, Lila? After all these years, it's Grace.
Incredible, Mom said. How have you been?
This is an unexpected surprise,
Dad added.
What brings you here to the Hamptons?
We are staying with the de Konings. My husband and Dirk are childhood friends.
By my father's expression, I could tell he didn't register the name.
You all knew each other in Buenos Aires? I chimed in.
Yes, that's right. Grace and I studied law together at the Universidad de Buenos Aires,
he said, becoming animated as he mentioned his alma mater.
My God, that building was falling apart inside even then. And the hours we spent at the library, it turned out to be a monumental waste of time, at least for me. But we had fun, didn't we?
Yes, we did,
Grace said with a laugh.
My goodness, it sure is good to see you again,
he said, kissing her lightly on the cheek.
I think an encounter like this deserves a toast, Mom said.
She lifted her empty champagne flute and signaled to a waiter. As the waiter refreshed our glasses, Grace's husband Eric ambled over. After Dad shared a couple of stories from their law school days that had everyone laughing, Grace turned to me and said,
Your father hasn't aged at all. Like many men my age, my hair is getting thinner and my waist is growing thicker,
Dad said with his typical self-deprecating charm.
You mean to say that you have a thin waist and thick hair?
Grace laughed, calling him out on his false modesty. She spoke to him in a familiar tone, and it delighted me to see the affection between him and an old friend. He was remarkably fit and slender in middle age. His dark brown hair, brushed back with a hint of gel, had only recently started showing silver near his temples, enhancing his distinguished looks. "He was the most handsome man in our class," Grace said to the group. My father raised his hand in protest.
"No, no, Santiago, don't try to say otherwise. You were quite a catch."
As his daughter, I hadn't really been aware of my father's charisma until one night at my high school's winter festival, when I overheard a couple of senior girls in my class agreeing that if they were going to have an affair with an older man, they'd go for someone like Mr. Larrea. Then they giggled at some of the other dads with bulging bellies, weak chins, and receding hairlines. Grace continued,
"The problem is, you knew it. But I think our friend Maximo came in a close second. Wouldn't you agree, Lila?
Aren't most 20-something-year-old men good-looking? You know, when you're that young?"
Mom suggested casually, but her tone was slightly pitched. Dad and I knew well enough that this only happened when she was nervous. Mom gripped her champagne glass while smiling politely at their unexpected visitors.
"I see that life has been kind to you," Grace said to my father.
"It's true. I've been blessed."
Dad put a protective arm around Mom.
"Not so for some others, we knew."
"Those were complicated times, Grace. Anyway, now's not the time for boring old stories."
"Boring?"
Grace turned to me.
"Paloma, I wonder how much you know about Argentina during those years."
I glanced at my parents. Talk of Argentina's military dictatorship in the 1970s had been taboo in our family for as long as I could remember.
"Sadly, not much," I told Grace.
"Well, I think you should be aware that thanks to your father, many people were spared."
"I said not now, Grace."
My father's sharp tone startled her into silence. He opened his mouth to say something else, but then closed it again. Grace looked at him with a pained expression before turning on her heel and walking off.
"I didn't mean to upset her,"
Dad mumbled without quite looking at anyone.
"She has a good memory, but that really was a long time ago."
He turned to Eric.
"I'm sorry if I was abrupt." "Not at all. I should be the one to apologize for her," Eric said. "Sometimes she likes to talk about the old days in Argentina, especially if she's had a drink or two. She's been an expat for years now, so I think she was excited to see an old friend from university. I'm sure you understand." "Of course. No need to apologize. Please."
As soon as Eric left, Mom turned to Dad.
"She still has eyes for you. That's clear enough," my mother said. She was long accustomed, if not resigned, to the effect her husband had on women.
I hadn't given much thought to my father's life as a bachelor, but Grace's remarks made me wonder. What had he been like as a young man?
"Grace is stuck in the past," Dad said. "It happened to some people. They haven't been able to move on. I did. That's all."
"But she said people's lives were spared because of you," I said. "What did she mean by that?" It was not often that I was on the receiving end of one of my father's withering looks, a look he'd bestow on a housekeeper when a shirt had not been pressed properly or when the coffee was not prepared to his liking. But when he spoke next, his tone was gentle.
"Ancient history, sweetheart,"
he said. My parents then turned with wide smiles to a group of approaching guests, signaling the end of the discussion. I wandered around the edge of the lawn to the front side of the house, where cars lined the driveway. I glimpsed Grace and Eric in the back seat of a sedan. The rear window rolled down.
"Paloma,"
Grace smiled at me.
"I really enjoyed meeting you."
"Me too.
I'm sorry about my father. I hardly ever see him like that. I don't know what came over him." Grace took a moment before answering.
"When you get to be my age, you tend to focus on chance encounters that, at the time, seemed like nothing of consequence, but later turned out to be defining moments.
I don't follow,
Eric murmured into Grace's ear.
My husband's right. I'm not making much sense right now. Time to go.
Grace reached her arm through the window to press my hand.
Have you heard of the Argentine writer Martin Torres?
No.
You should look for his books. He's a fantastic writer. Take good care.
Before I could react, the car pulled away. I tossed my sandals in the general direction of my closet and tugged and cursed at the fabric of my dress caught in the zipper. It finally gave way, and I pulled on a pair of sweatpants and a t-shirt. Coco, our cat, slunk into the bedroom and brushed my leg, announcing his presence. I scooped him up, his warm body like a balm on my skin.
You're still my one and only,
even if you abandoned me for Mama. I sat at my desk, opened my laptop, and connected the line to the phone jack, waiting impatiently for the dial-up modem to proceed through its sounds. Once logged in, I typed Graciela de Graf and Graciela Diaz into a search engine and found zero relevant results. I changed it to Grace and alternated in both last names. Still no luck. Faint sounds of music, laughter, and clinking glasses floated through the open window. Then I looked up Martin Torres, and dozens of entries appeared. A brief biography about the acclaimed Argentine author explained that he had lived exiled in Spain during the South American country's dictatorship, but had returned to his homeland a few years after democracy was restored in 1983. I added Santiago Larrea to Martin Torres as an additional search term, and I came across his Jorge Luis Borges Award acceptance speech from 1988.
Among the people I want to thank this evening, I am particularly grateful to Santiago Larrea. Without him, I wouldn't be here standing in front of you. He was one of the few who, in his own way, took action.
Why had Dad never talked about Martin Torres? And what did he do that was important enough for Torres to mention him in a speech? Also, what did Grace mean when she said my dad had spared people's lives? Coco rubbed my leg. I stroked the fur between his shoulder blades and looked out the window. There was no longer any music. The party had ended.
Chapter 2. June, 1973.
Libertador Avenue, on any typical weekday morning, was a stream of buses and cars. Today, however, traffic was at a standstill across all five lanes in each direction. An accident? A broken traffic light? Santiago Larrea couldn't see what was going on and regretted not having walked to class. He shifted his Volkswagen Beetle down to first gear and looked mindlessly out the window at the upscale apartment towers along the boulevard to his right. His family's apartment was just beyond these high-rises, in Recoleta, the neighborhood that gave Buenos Aires its fame as the Paris of South America. Jacaranda trees, which would burst into clusters of purple blooms in October, lined the small green parks that bordered the avenue and dotted the neighborhood. As his car crawled toward the colonnades of the Universidad de Buenos Aires Law School building on the left, Santiago noticed an unusually high number of people passing him on foot. He recognized one of the students and rolled down his window.
Are classes canceled? Is there another strike? It's Perón. We're going to the Ezeiza airport to welcome him home.
General Juan Domingo Perón, the former president of Argentina, had been living in exile since being ousted in a military coup d'etat 18 years earlier. Nonetheless, his presence still towered over the country's politics, and he retained millions of loyal followers. During his absence, instability and polarization had taken root, fueled by the rise of guerrilla groups on the left and paramilitary groups on the right. In March, Argentina conducted its first national election in a decade. Héctor José Cámpora, a stand-in candidate for Perón, narrowly prevailed,
paving the way for the exiled general to return and re-establish himself on the political stage. Santiago thanked the student and drove on, shaking his head, slightly embarrassed. He had forgotten about Perón after his late night out. He turned off the avenue and found a parking spot on a side street. The weather had turned cold with the arrival of winter in the southern hemisphere, but in his haste, Santiago had forgotten his jacket. He wore blue jeans and a button-down shirt under a navy V-neck sweater. With the momentary ebb of military rule and the prevailing fashion of the time, Santiago, like many Argentine men, let his hair grow out. It fell to his jaw and he wore it combed back. At a newsstand by the Café de las Artes, he noticed the same headlines across all the papers. Perón returns. Multitudes mobilized toward Ezeiza to await the leader of justicialism. Santiago picked up a copy. The photo on the cover showed a triumphant Perón outside his home in Madrid. Standing next to him was his third wife, María Estela Martínez de Perón. Familiarly known as Isabelita, she had been a cabaret dancer when Perón met her early in his exile. Café de las Artes was a favorite among students, mainly for its proximity to the School of Law and the School of Social Sciences. While it had none of the old charm of the city's grand historic cafés, like the Richmond or the Tortoni, it made up for it with a young and exuberant clientele. A long, oaked-paneled bar ran along one side in the style of an English pub, but for the most part the students sat at crowded round tables, pushing aside the stainless steel napkin dispensers and small bowls brimming with sugar cubes to make room for notebooks and newspapers. Santiago spotted his friend at a table in the back corner. Her chestnut bangs grazed her tortoiseshell glasses as she sat there reading. Although her given name was Graciela, the anglicized version, Grace, had been her nickname since childhood. Her features were plain, but no one noticed due to her quick tongue, tenacious personality, and bohemian flair. She was wearing a buttery leather jacket over beige corduroy pants and a black cashmere turtleneck. He kissed her cheek and sat down. "You're late," she said.
"Sorry, Grace. Traffic's a mess. You could have started reviewing without me."
"Class is canceled. There's no exam."
"Well, that's a relief," Santiago said, still feeling the effects of too little sleep and too much alcohol from the night before.
Grace stubbed out her cigarette and stood up.
"Don't get too comfortable. You're coming with me."
"Where?"
"We're going to Ezeiza."
"The airport? Why? It's going to be a nightmare. A million people are expected to show up."
"Santi," Grace said, calling Santiago by his nickname. "Come on. Give me a ride. Let's embrace this historic occasion."
"But I'm not a Peronista."
"I know, I know. You're strictly a Larreaista," she cajoled him.
"I'm going back to bed," he said, picking up his backpack.
"No, you're not," she said and nudged his back. "We can tell our kids one day we were there at the airport the day Perón came back from exile."
After touching down in Ezeiza, Perón was planning to give a speech from a temporary stage that had been erected for the occasion in an open field 10 kilometers from the airport. It was a strange setup for a major political address, but Perón wanted to speak directly to his followers as soon as he landed and didn't want anyone else dictating the logistics of his return. In a show of power against Cámpora, the 77-year-old Caudillo had rejected possible alternative sites within the city that Cámpora's team had suggested, such as the Plaza de Mayo, the capital's main square, or the base of the obelisk monument that rose up 221 feet from the middle of the widest avenue on earth, the 14-lane Avenida 9 de Julio. Santiago envisioned a chaotic drive to the outskirts of the capital, but he finally agreed.
"Fine. You owe me one, Grace," he said, as she nudged him toward the door.
"Don't worry. It'll be worth it," she teased him.
"I'll introduce you to that cute girl you've had your eyes on in our civil procedures class."
They drove northwest out of the city, then looped back southwest onto the highway toward the airport. The road was congested in both directions.
When they couldn't drive any farther, still a mile or so from the airport, they parked the car on one of the flat fields by the side of the road and joined the throngs of people. It felt to Santiago like a pilgrimage. The procession of 2 million people took on a festive tone. Students, couples, and entire families with their children were walking hand in hand, singing the Peronist anthem and taking photos of each other waving the peace sign. While living abroad, Juan Perón had taken on mythical proportions, even as his justicialist party had split into right and left-wing factions. Many believed his return would bring back the good union jobs, affordable food, and other benefits that Perón was credited with bestowing on them during his 2 terms in office. Others, including students who had come of age during his absence, thought it would bring about a social revolution. Santiago, however, wasn't one of those students, and he suspected that neither was Grace. But she was a curious, enthusiastic type, and she enjoyed being part of something bigger than herself. They came into view of a large podium outside the International Airport Hotel, where Perón would address the gathered supporters. Behind the platform hung enormous smiling posters of Perón and his iconic second wife, Eva Duarte. Evita was a country girl and aspiring actress whose biggest role would be marrying the great Caudillo and becoming the First Lady of the Argentinians. A champion of workers and women's rights, Evita died from breast cancer at the age of 33. The descamisados, or shirtless ones, the poor workers who were part of the backbone of Perón's political support, worshipped her as a saint. Santa Evita. Perón's chartered plane from Madrid had yet to land, but the crowd was already pressing forward to be as close as possible to the stage. Santiago and Grace stayed back. It was pointless to try to advance further. As the morning wore on, Santiago's impatience changed to irritation. Grace was talking to a woman carrying her baby in a sling. He was about to tell Grace he was leaving, when his restless gaze drifted over the sea of humans undulating across the flat green fields on both sides of the highway. Suddenly, a few popping sounds drew his eyes back to the stage. Near the front, individuals were crumpling to the ground. Only then did he realize that the popping sounds were gunfire. Snipers had infiltrated the masses, and the shots seemed to be coming from all directions. He spotted men with rifles in the treetops. From the stage, men were shooting randomly into the crowd. Santiago found himself jostled from all sides. The odors from strangers' bodies assaulted his nostrils. He felt a crush, and then a stranger's breath in his face as he stumbled to the ground. Grace had fallen too. Santiago, who knew from shooting at his family's ranch how much harder it was to target a moving animal, yelled at Grace to run. They pushed and shoved to get away from the stage until the crowd thinned out and they were at a safe distance. Pausing to catch his breath, Santiago looked back at the scene they had just fled. Around the stage and beyond, piles of bodies remained flattened on the ground. "What the hell is happening?" Santiago shouted. It took barking orders from police megaphones to get Santiago and Grace, unable to tear their eyes away from the mayhem, to start running again and not stop until they reached his car. Their faces were streaked with dirt. Her pants had ripped at one knee. His sweater was soiled. Only when Santiago struggled to turn the key in the ignition did he notice how much his hands were trembling. Chapter 3. August 1998. The Sunday morning after the asado, I went for a run on the beach and met Juan and his friends for lunch before they headed back to Manhattan. My mother, ever the proper hostess, occupied herself with the house guests until their departure, then retreated to her bedroom with one of her headaches, which seemed to come on during moments of stress or tension. My father was distant, and I took this to mean he was still annoyed with me for pressing him for more information about Grace the night before. Since this had been our last interaction, I was surprised when my father phoned me a week later to tell me that he and Mom were planning to spend a couple weeks at the ranch in Argentina before his swearing-in ceremony, and asked me to join them.
If not for my sake, it's been ages since you visited Abuelo at the ranch, he said.
In his voice I heard amends, and he called me Palomita, like he used to when I was little. I did not accept the invitation on the spot, but the opportunity intrigued me. Until the conversation with Grace, I had always believed my family, like many of the Argentine elite, had not had their lives disrupted by the dictatorship. But her words cast doubt on that account. My father's comment echoed in my head.
Some people remained stuck in the past, but I was able to move on.
Move on from what, exactly? I called my father back a few minutes later to tell him I would come. On a muggy, hazy evening 2 weeks later, I met my parents at JFK Airport for the overnight flight to Buenos Aires. Dad greeted me with a kiss.
Now that you've left us for Brooklyn, I feel like we never see you anymore.
I could have spent the summer in Manhattan, enjoying the comforts of our family's Upper East Side apartment, but when Emily asked if I would go in with her on a summer sublet, I didn't hesitate. I had grown accustomed to the freedom that came with going away to college, and my parents' place felt less and less like home. My mother embraced me and said how nice it would be to have us all together at the ranch. Mom usually complained about going back to Argentina, whereas I always looked forward to it. Maybe that's why I had a strong bond with my father. His decades on Wall Street had done nothing to diminish his pride in his heritage. Well before his diplomatic appointment, he had been an unofficial ambassador for Argentinian arts and culture. In contrast, my mother seemed to notice only what was wrong with the country, its corruption and endless crises, constantly comparing it to what she believed to be the superior examples of England, where her parents had recently retired, and the United States. My family's ranch, Estancia El Pinar, was located a 2-hour drive west from the suburban sprawl of the outer ring of Greater Buenos Aires, in the heart of the humid Pampas region. This agricultural area, considered to have some of the most fertile soil in the world, encompasses nearly 250,000 square miles of flat land that spans several provinces. For a brief period of time in the early 20th century, the region's prodigious exports of grain, oilseed, and beef placed Argentina among the top 5 wealthiest nations in the world, notwithstanding the chronic instability of its politics and the corruption of the governing classes. Whatever the politicians steal during the day grows back at night, the old saying went. But after 8 decades of relative stagnation, it no longer held true, even as a joke. It had been 3 years since my family had last been to Argentina, and the flight turned out not to be as bad as I remembered. As soon as the airplane cabin went dark, I fell asleep, my book open on my lap. Only when the captain's voice came on, announcing the beginning of our descent into Ezeiza Airport, did I finally emerge from a dull sleep. My father had already received diplomatic credentials from the consulate in New York, and this allowed us to breeze through customs. A porter took our baggage as we exited the customs zone into the chaos of the arrivals area. People from the various kiosks promoting taxis and buses into the city noisily competed for passengers, pressing flyers into their hands and asking for their final destinations. Families, friends, and drivers holding up signs with clients' names jostled for space behind rope barriers.
Mr. Ambassador!
A driver in a coat and tie stepped forward.
Not just yet, but thank you, Daniel,
Dad said with a broad smile.
Good to see you.
They shook hands. Daniel turned to my mom with a bow.
Mrs. Larrea, I hope you had a good flight.
Thank you, Daniel. We're a little tired, but glad to be here,
answered my mother, looking perfectly well-rested. After Daniel instructed the porter to follow us with the luggage, we navigated around the crowds and approached a car with tinted windows illegally parked by the curb. Under the gray morning sky, the humid winter air felt refreshingly cool against my skin. The porter loaded the suitcases into the trunk while Mom arranged herself in the back seat. As my father was tipping the porter, A slim man in a dark blue suit walked up to him.
Mr. Larrea? Yes. For you.
The stranger handed him a folded letter without an envelope, which my father briefly glanced at. I couldn't read what it said, but saw that it had been written by hand. It didn't look like official ministry correspondence. I got into the car with my mother.
Are you coming, Papa?
Dad folded the note and joined us in the back seat. At his signal, Daniel shifted into gear, and the car pulled away. A few miles after leaving the airport, we passed a shantytown where children were playing soccer on a patch of dirt. A couple of mangy dogs barked and chased after the ball. Denser concentrations of dilapidated housing projects gradually replaced the brown grassy fields as we approached the city, and we soon found ourselves in the tail end of the morning rush hour. Small Fiats and Peugeots weaved in and out of their lanes with little or no respect for the painted lines. Gripping the door handle, I shut my eyes each time a car cut in front of us. My parents, unfazed, chatted with Daniel while the morning radio talk show blared from the backseat speakers. Dad had instructed Daniel to make a stop in the city center before heading to the ranch. Paperwork was being held for him at a government office near the presidential palace. We took the steep ramp off the elevated highway onto Avenida Entre Ríos. With relative ease, we sped along the tree-lined avenue before making our way to Avenida de Mayo. I leaned my forehead against the window and peered up at the sloped gray roofs of the grand Osmanian buildings along the stately old boulevard, running down from Congress to the presidential palace. As we emerged onto the circular Plaza de Mayo, a wide public square surrounded on all sides by government ministries, I saw a group of about 3 dozen older women marching slowly around the pyramid monument in the square's center. Each one wore a white headscarf, some embroidered with a name and a date. The large placards they carried bore black and white photos of mostly young men and women with their names underneath. Jorge Ocampo, María Esther Lacroix, Carlos Caballero, Olga Agüero. Below some of the photos, the word desaparecido was written in large black letters. The women held the signs on what looked like broom handles. Many wore angry expressions, while others appeared simply weary.
The Madres de Plaza de Mayo, Daniel explained, when he noticed in the rearview mirror that I was staring at them. Those poor mothers. They won't stop coming to the square until the government tells them what happened to their children. They're here every Thursday. It's been 20 years now.
The traffic halted, and I lowered the window to better hear their chants.
Queremos nuestros hijos. Con vida los llevaron. Con vida los queremos.
We want our children. You took them away alive. We want them back alive. Not knowing what happened to your son or daughter must be awful, I said. I knew about the Madres de Plaza de Mayo, but had never seen them in person on the few visits I had ever made to the city. When the car moved again, my father said,
Look, Paloma, my swearing-in ceremony will take place there, in the Casa Rosada.
He pointed to the seat of Argentina's executive branch, a sprawling Spanish colonial building with a pink facade known as the Pink House.
Impressive. Looks like I'll have to take you more seriously from now on, I replied teasingly.
It would be about time, wouldn't it?
He said, smiling. Chapter 4. June, 1973. 10 days after the massacre at the international airport, Santiago and Grace returned to class, still rattled by what they had witnessed. Following a tedious day of committing pages of cases and statutes to memory, they were glad to escape the confines of the library. It was a chilly night, and raindrops were beginning to fall as they hurried north up Avenida Figueroa Alcorta toward their destination. Cracked and buckled cement and sections of the sidewalk made for an obstacle course until they finally found the awning of an elegant building to shelter them from the driving rain. Santiago stepped out into the street and hailed one of the few empty cabs. The taxi eventually pulled over in front of a nondescript apartment building in Palermo. Lugging book bags, they climbed the stairs to the fourth floor. Laughter and music could be heard from behind one of the doors. Santiago knocked, and when no one answered, they let themselves in. After helping Grace out of her coat, Santiago waited as she tugged her fringed suede miniskirt over her cable-knit tights. He hadn't been keen on going to a party, preferring to grab drinks and dinner somewhere quiet. But once again, Grace had talked him into it, telling him that their friend Maximo, whom they hadn't seen in days, would be there. She was about to remove her glasses and hide them in her coat pocket when Santiago caught her wrist.
Grace, you look good. Come on, let's get a drink.
They inched their way through the room until they spotted Maximo in a corner. Maximo Cassini, when Santiago first met him, wore his hair short and slicked down, parted to one side. Now his friend had let his wavy hair grow long and had developed a nervous habit of constantly smoothing loose strands behind his ears. Judging from his dark stubble, Santiago guessed that Maximo hadn't shaved in some time. That, combined with his aquiline nose and strong jaw, gave him an effortless allure. The black leather jacket that he wore year-round had been a wardrobe staple since the beginning of their friendship. They had met during the first semester of law school. Santiago and Grace, already in the habit of studying together, had stopped by Café de las Artes after class for coffee. Maximo was sitting at a corner table, smoking while reading. They recognized him from one of their classes, and Grace went to his table to ask for a light. Without saying a word, Maximo rose from his chair and pulled out a book of matches. Santiago introduced himself with a firm handshake and then sat down at Maximo's table, uninvited. He ordered 3 cortados, and soon the three of them were comparing notes on classes and professors. The waiters left them alone until just before closing time, when the lights dimmed and most of the chairs had been stacked upside down on the tables. They continued their conversation along Libertador Avenue until Maximo glanced at his watch and told them he had to turn back to catch his bus at Retiro Station. Maximo was from Quilmes, a working-class town south of Buenos Aires, where his father, like his father before him, was employed at the Quilmes Spear Plant. On a good day, bus number 22 got him home in about 50 minutes. Before parting ways, the three promised to meet the next day at the library. Over the next few weeks, it seemed to some of their classmates that they had become inseparable. Maximo was huddled in a corner talking to the host of the gathering, a leftist student leader named Enrique Medina. He had a slight build and wore a mustache and wire-rimmed glasses that enhanced his brainy reputation. They were talking about the massacre at Ezeiza Airport. Newspapers reported 10, then 13, then 16 deaths. Hundreds were injured, but exact numbers were never confirmed. In addition to undercounting the casualties, Enrique said the newspapers had also failed to report that some people had been sequestered in the airport hotel's rooms, where they had been questioned and tortured. After Enrique finished his report and moved on to another group, Maximo went over to Santiago and Grace. Santiago put his arms around his two friends before either of them began talking.
I think I've had my fill of politics for the day. What do you say? Time for a drink?
Santiago said.
Sure. But when was the last time you took an interest in anything political anyway, Santi?
Maximo asked with a wry smile. The makeshift bar was in the kitchen. A sangria pitcher sat empty on the counter. Santiago grabbed a knife and a couple of lemons. Maximo took the other knife and set about cutting an orange with enviable precision.
You're too slow, che. Nobody's going to admire your cutting skills, Santiago complained. If you cut fruit in a sloppy way, it ends up mushy in the wine. Who cares? Always arguing, you two. I'll show you how it's done, Grace said, grabbing an orange from Maximo's hand.
Neither man showed any interest. Their attention was now on a woman in a long black skirt and puffy-sleeved white chiffon blouse standing nearby. Long dark curls framed her face. She was alone, but appeared at ease listening to the music. Someone called out to the woman, and Santiago and Maximo followed her petite frame with their eyes as she crossed the room. How had Santiago not noticed her before? He put down a half-cut lemon and, with his trademark devil-may-care grin, said to Maximo,
"I saw her first, friend."
"She's all yours,"
Maximo replied with a brief shrug of his shoulders and returned to cutting the fruit with grace. Holding three full glasses of wine above his head and energized by the thrill of a new potential conquest, Santiago deftly moved through the crowd to where she sat. When the woman noticed him standing in front of her, she gazed up from under dark eyelashes. Santiago felt the unusual sensation of a sharp tug in his chest. It was as though his heart were rebelling against his brain, which was mostly hardwired to conquer and move on. Bewildered, he looked to her for an answer. But she had turned back to her companion, indifferent to Santiago's inner turmoil. He would offer his heart, he thought. No, he would insist she take his heart. As she talked to her girlfriend, seemingly unaware of him, he understood his heart was no longer his. The wine glasses, when he lowered them, brought him back. He bent down to the woman's eye level, but again he became distracted, this time by her nonchalant beauty. He searched for words until he came up with one that made sense.
"Thirsty?"
"Yes, thank you,"
her girlfriend replied. His composure regained, he sat down beside them. The woman gave him a quizzical look, but silently accepted the sangria.
"I would like to drink to your happiness," Santiago said, raising his glass. "Here's to... Wait, I can't drink to you if I don't know your names."
The other one giggled.
"I'm Florencia. I'm in your torts class, remember?"
"Oh, yes, of course. How are you?" Santiago said, not having a clue who Florencia was.
He was usually distracted or daydreaming, not paying attention to his surroundings, unless Maximo or Grace were in the same class, in which case they'd be all seated together, uninterested in the others. Some students didn't attend classes, preferring to study at home or in the library, showing up only for appraisals, which were mostly in the form of oral exams held in front of a panel of professors from the department. But Santiago enjoyed the sport of academic banter and preferred the ritual of going to class and then meeting up with Maximo and Grace at the library or Café de las Artes. The musician started playing a Cuban folk song, which Santiago recognized as "Hasta siempre, comandante." And the woman, who had not given him her name, got up to join them. Santiago watched her close her eyes and open her mouth to sing the lyrics. The song was a reply in verse to Ernesto Che Guevara's farewell letter to Cuba, which he sent before embarking on his ill-fated journey to bring revolution to the South American continent. Santiago prepared to follow the woman, but Florencia had moved over so that their knees touched. When he didn't respond to her advances, she understood.
"You don't have to stay with me just to be polite. It's obvious you want to be with her. Go on. Her name is Valentina."
Chapter 5. August, 1998. After a short stop outside an administrative building off the Plaza de Mayo, we arrived at the ranch a couple of hours later. The car drove through a gate built with heavy trunks of wood, past the familiar wooden post that read El Pinar, and down a packed dirt lane lined by a single row of pine trees. Flat fields extended out on either side as far as the eye could see. We continued on a gravel road and came to a stop in front of a colonial home with whitewashed walls and a red clay roof. A couple of barking dogs came barreling toward us, announcing our arrival.
"At last!"
My grandfather, Alfonso Larrea, smiled widely as his longtime nurse, Karina, pushed his wheelchair out the main door.
"Come to me, Paloma," he ordered.
"Abuelo!"
I hugged him, feeling his bony shoulders through his wool sweater.
"Papa, how have you been?"
Dad took my grandfather's hand, bending to kiss his cheek.
It took a fancy government appointment to get you to come to visit your own father,
Abuelo responded gruffly. But when Mom approached, he smiled again. The 100-year-old property was a hacienda-style house, consisting of 4 wings, connected by an interior garden. Far from a rustic farmhouse, El Pinar was filled with exquisite antiques and furniture, an eclectic mix of colonial and European art acquired in Argentina and on my grandparents' trips abroad. Once we had refreshed in our rooms, we reconvened in the cavernous dining room. Standing lamps and a tiered chandelier brightened the space. When I was a kid, the chandelier was fitted with real candles, and I remember half hoping the wax would drip down on the table during one of our meals. It made for a thrilling pastime while the adults engaged in long conversations. The chandelier now flickered with electric candles. Not as dramatic, I thought, but infinitely more practical. Lunch consisted of roasted lamb and potatoes with butter and chives, accompanied by a bottle of Mendoza Malbec. I had a glass of wine and then stuck to club soda, which I sprayed into a glass from a violet-colored soda siphon. After my favorite dessert, flan with dulce de leche, was served, we moved to the living room. A maid had left a tray with coffee and tea on a square leather coffee table. Abuelo and I settled into a game of backgammon. Mom pulled a beige merino wool wrap around her shoulders. It was a drafty room, and Dad, who had poured hot cups of tea and coffee for the group, stood up again to build a fire. My grandmother, Constanza, had died a few years earlier, and evidence of her absence was everywhere. In the burned-out light bulbs in the chandeliers, the rips in the leather upholstery on the living room chairs, tired-looking mementos on display, and the pile of yellowed newspapers that Dad was now crumpling into the base of the fireplace. When the kindling crackled and flames shot up the sides of the logs, he turned to my mother. How's that?
Better, thank you.
Her eyes had been scanning every room since our arrival, taking mental notes on what needed to be discarded, replaced, redecorated. Checking on the fire occasionally, Dad had sat down to read one of the national newspapers. Abuelo blew into his cupped hands and rolled double sixes.
Ha!
He said, and smiled. I conceded defeat.
When will I ever beat you, Abuelo?
Play another one? He offered.
Karina entered the room.
Don Alfonso, it would be good for you to get some fresh air before your siesta.
Join me, Paloma?
Sure.
Far off, sheep and cattle grazed side by side in the field. Lustrous shoots of grass were essential to producing the world's best beef. The property was also scattered with the eye-catching cortadera, known in North America as pampas grass, that easily grew to over 6 feet. I remembered past summers when these tall golden grasses bloomed into translucent feathery tufts, beautiful to look at as they fluttered and rustled in the wind, but razor sharp to the touch. One of the ranch hands tipped his beret in our direction as he led some horses back to the stables. We reached the brick and adobe quincho that housed the grill next to a long picnic table with benches. The swimming pool had been covered with a tarp for the winter. When we arrived at the pond, Abuelo asked Karina to help him out of his wheelchair. We put our arms around his waist and lifted him up. He straightened out his back until he was as tall and regal as he had once been.